I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, the maker of natural household and personal care products such as unbleached diapers, wipes, dishwashing detergent, and tissues. Jeffrey has been a leading advocate of corporate social responsibility, and he's the author of several books on greener living. Welcome.
Great. Happy to be here.
You grew up in New York City, and you came from a very privileged background. How did you feel about that background?
You know, I had very, very mixed feelings. I mean, I grew up on Park Avenue and went to private schools, and at the same time was sort of acutely aware of while I had so much, there were many people who had very little. I think particularly as I entered my teenage years and the Vietnam War was going on and there was a huge sort of social questioning that was going on with partially my generation, and people were saying, you know, what's right, what's wrong, what's my responsibility? And as these questions were being asked, I felt like I couldn't explain why I had this very comfortable, privileged lifestyle when so many people didn't have much. I remember going to rallies, you know, probably when I was 15 or 16, going down to Washington, D.C. on a bus to demonstrate in Washington. And in many ways, that experience sort of shaped my life. I grew up both with a strong sense of responsibility that we had to be engaged in the social and political issues of our time, and also the belief that you can actually make a difference because ultimately we had a positive impact on slowing and ultimately ending the war in Vietnam.
What was your parents' response to, you know, you're going to protest in Washington, D.C., and you're going to six private schools? How many private schools did you juggle among?
Oh, probably at least six. You know, I had a dad who was running an ad agency and who was a very conservative businessman. He was Jewish at a time where it was somewhat uncomfortable to be Jewish in the business world. And a mom who was really more bohemian, who was an actress, an artist. And so they both had very different perspectives on my personal orientation, but mostly it was one of indifference. I mean, they were not involved in my life the way I am involved in my three children's life. They would periodically put pressure on me, mostly my dad. When I dropped out of college, he was very distraught. I mean, you know, he sold hot dogs in the sporting arena to pay for his college education. And he felt that I would go into an interview and I would be asked where I went to college and I would be embarrassed by the fact that I had to say I dropped out of college. And I tried to explain to him that I never planned on going on a job interview because I never planned on working for someone else. He also, interestingly, the business I started in Toronto, the Skills Exchange of Toronto, which was an adult education program, was a nonprofit. And he was very upset that I was working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day on a nonprofit. So there were a lot of disconnects. When I sold my second company, which was a books on tape company, to Warner Communications at the age of 29, and he was sitting in the room and got a check for $1 million for his investment, that was a turning point in his attitude about me. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, money is what mattered. And the fact that I had made so much money at an early age sort of meant that I won his approval in a way that nothing else that I had done up to that point did.
Did it matter to you that you had his approval?
Absolutely. You know, it meant a lot to me that not only had I succeeded by my own metrics, but I had succeeded according to his metrics.
You mentioned that you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur, that you were never going to work for somebody else. Why did you have such a distaste in your mouth for working for other people?
God, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. In part, when you start your own business at such an early age, I never had the experience of having anybody tell me what to do in a work context. So it might simply be that when you start out life as an entrepreneur, it's very hard to go back. You know, to be an entrepreneur, you're sort of – not only do you have to provide yourself with your own direction and instruction, but you have to create your own context. And I think it's hard to have someone give that to you when you spent your life creating it for yourself.
You started your first business when you were 14 years old. It was a window washing company in the Hamptons on Long Island. Talk to me a little bit about that.
West Hampton window washing. It was amazing how much money people would pay to get their windows washed. I mean, people would pay a couple $100 to get their windows washed. My brother and I, who worked at the business together, could do a house or two in a day. And at $200 a pop at 14, 15 years old, that was a lot of money. It took me a long time to make as much money as I was making when I was that young.
So you graduated, or you didn't graduate from Hampshire College. You left to go to California?
Yep. I left school, at the beginning of 12th grade. I had spent a lot of time in California during the summer to go surfing. This is one chapter of a sort of turbulent, confused childhood. But I had left Riverdale to go to Putney School in Vermont. I was there for a year and a half, didn't like it, came back to Riverdale for the second half of 11th grade, and then started Riverdale. I was there for a week or two and came to the conclusion that I wanted to go back to California, and left at the beginning of 12th grade, moved into my car on a cliff overlooking a surf break in Santa Barbara, got myself into Santa Barbara High School, and, you know, spent most of that year in Santa Barbara going to school.
And then when you didn't graduate from Hampshire College, you decided to start an adult education business. How did that happen?
I was reading Ivan Illich's book, and a lot of people don't even know Ivan Illich, but Ivan Illich was a wonderful educational philosopher. In this book called Deschooling Society, he has a chapter on something called skills exchanges, and he has this philosophy that organized, institutionalized education is more about constraining the flow of knowledge than encouraging the flow of knowledge. And he said, you know, knowledge is everywhere. And what he described in these skills exchanges are getting someone like you who knows about, you know, radio production to teach a course in radio production, getting a sushi chef to teach a course on cooking. And his notion was to harness the wisdom of our society and make it available to anyone and everyone who's interested. And the Skills Exchange of Toronto, you know, was not about my passion for any particular educational subject, but about the notion of changing the paradigm that we think about education within, and this marvelous experience of people coming up with all of these crazy, wacky ideas for courses, and people sign up, go to someone's house, and have a wonderful experience learning. We had courses, how to lose your Brooklyn accent, what to do when your therapist is away on vacation, the art of flirting, and the most famous of all courses, How to Marry Money, which became a book and a video and lots of other things. You can tell by the titles of those courses that there was not much focus on solving the problems that were facing society.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. So we're talking about the early days of prior to launching Seventh Generation, when you launched two adult education businesses. One was the Skills Exchange Toronto, and the next was Network for Learning. What was going on in your personal life at the time? When did you marry your wife, Sheila?
Sheila and I got together sort of at the end of the Network for Learning time just before I sold the business to Warner Publishing. Like most businesses I've started, that business almost crashed and burned before it succeeded. So she came into my life just as it looked like I was incredibly successful. The whole thing fell apart. I moved the business into my apartment. I moved out of my apartment into her apartment to keep the thing going, and then 2 years later sold it for a fair amount of money. So she came into my life, I think, sort of confused about what I am. You know, am I successful? Am I not successful? Am I a socially oriented, politically minded person, or am I just a capitalist who wants to make as much money as possible?
But you seem confused about who you were, too, up until you finally acquired this company in 1988 called Renew America, which then later became Seventh Generation. Was that the catalyst for your having more of a focus of what you wanted to be and merging corporate responsibility with profit motive?
Well, after I left Network for Learning, which became Warner Audio Publishing after I sold it, I wrote my first book called How to Make the World a Better Place, A Beginner's Guide. It was really my exploration of, well, what are the opportunities to make the world a better place? What can you do? Coming out of having written that book, I said, you know, I want to have a product that makes a positive contribution to the world, not a product that makes money that allows me to donate some money to a cause. And that was the aspiration behind Seventh Generation.
So Seventh Generation came out of this company that actually had been in bankruptcy called Renew America, which was a mail order catalog company for green products. How did you go about finding this company to take it on?
So when I was writing the book, I came across this Renew America catalog, and I thought, wow, you know, what a cool idea, you know, a catalog that only has good products for the planet. And I love the idea. Little did I know that there weren't a lot of people interested in buying those products. And so by the time the book was done, they were out of business. And they had given the catalog to Alan Newman, who subsequently became my partner. And so Seventh Generation was the sort of rejuvenation and relaunch of that Renew America catalog.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, a leading brand of natural household products. We'll hear more from Jeffrey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation, the maker of natural household and personal care products such as unbleached diapers, wipes, dishwashing detergent, and tissues. Jeffrey has been a leading advocate of corporate social responsibility, and he's the author of several books on greener living. Seventh Generation is Iroquois. What does it mean?
Well, it comes from the equivalent of the Iroquois Bible. So the saying is, in our every deliberation, we should consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations. Every ad agency that we ever went to in the first decade said that is the worst name you could possibly have. No one is going to understand what it stands for. You know, they said you should be eco something or planet something or green something. And we thankfully stuck with it. And in a way, the name became a fundamental differentiator between us and every other company that was selling green products. The name was a story. The name held emotion in a way that, you know, Bounty or Tide or anything else just will never have.
So you met Alan Newman, who at the time was helping to run Renew America, and he was on board with Seventh Generation for just 4 or 5 years. How come he didn't stay with the company?
Well, we went through one of many disasters. First year, we did $100,000 of business. The second year, we did $1 million of business. The third year, we did $8 million of business. And we expected to do $20 or $30 million the year after. So We hired the people. We rented the space. We bought the inventory. We raised the money to continue what had been relatively spectacular growth. As we went into that fourth year, thinking we were going to do $20 or $30 million, we missed our numbers the first month, and we missed our numbers the second month, and we missed our numbers the third month. And all of a sudden, we knew that our forecast was wrong. We just didn't know how wrong it was. And it was a terrifying feeling because it was like falling without knowing where the bottom was. It was a terrifying, chaotic year in which you become focused on nothing but survival. And you realize that if you don't start cutting your expenses quickly enough, you'll just run out of money. And, you know, I think Alan would tell the story very differently, but there is an incredible excitement of that rapid growth. You know, you're like on a rocket ship that's taking off towards the moon, and the world is your oyster, and everyone thinks you're incredibly smart and you're successful. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're holding on for dear life, and you're wondering whether the business will make it till the end of the year. You know, a lot of people don't like that part of business. A lot of people don't like spending the day negotiating the copier lease to try to save money or convincing a vendor to give you another 10 days to pay a bill. And so in that turmoil, a lot of people said, hey, you know, this isn't as fun as it used to be. And so Alan and I parted ways in the midst of that turmoil. I naively said, well, my God, people invested all this money in the business. I've got to find a way to make it work.
Were you glad to see Alan leave?
No, it was a very, very sad and painful situation, I think, for both of us. We had become very close friends. We were partners in the best sense of the word. It was more the stress of the situation that caused us to separate than it was a philosophical difference. You know, at the time, I think he just had enough and he didn't want to deal with it anymore. And he said, you know, I need to take a break.
You talk about investors. Who was invested in the company at the time?
Luckily, I had done very well by the investors who put money into Network for Learning when the company was sold to Warner. So the foundational group of investors were many of the same people. They were more friends and family, much more so than venture investors. So we didn't have people who were clamoring to get inside and tell us what to do. They were pretty much happy to sit back knowing that if anyone was going to save it, we were going to figure out how to save it. It wasn't until, you know, a decade later that we took venture and private equity money. And in between that, we went public. I, after meeting with some venture firms, said, oh, my God, I'd much rather have thousands of little investors than one big investor. So we went public. And, you know, for a small company that was still losing money to go public, I mean, you probably couldn't do it today, but you could do it back in 93. So we had, you know, five, I would say, unsuccessful years as a public company, and at the end of 1999 went back to being a private company.
So it wasn't really until 2000 to 2005 that you really that the business really accelerated.
Yeah, I mean, there's this period of a decade where we were sort of wandering around lost in the forest. And then, you know, from 2000 to 2008, you know, we grew at an average rate of 30% a year. And our stock price went from $1.75 to $22.50. And in 2008, I stepped down as the CEO of the company.
What were some turning points in the business that got you going again?
Yeah. So there were a couple of key turning points. I mean, one was the realization that as important as people say the environment is, what really motivates them are issues of health and safety. And so the tagline for the company was initially products for a healthy planet. We switched the tagline to safer for you and the environment. That was a huge turning point because As a mom running down the aisle of the supermarket, you're not necessarily thinking about the Amazon rainforest. You're thinking about what is the healthiest product you can buy for your child first. And so that was a big turning point because it affected the products we sold, the way we positioned them, the way we marketed them, the way we designed them. The other biggest turning point was really Whole Foods' success, and Whole Foods was opening up more and more stores. They started opening up bigger and bigger stores, and in this totally bizarre way, I mean, Whole Foods was growing faster than the industry was growing of vendors to support them. So they had these big stores with lots of shelf space, and you would walk into a Whole Foods store, and we would have a whole aisle of seventh-generation products because they needed to fill up that space. They propelled us. Everyone wanted to look and see what they were doing and understand why they were so successful. And when they looked at the Whole Foods store, they would see, oh my God, there's all this seventh generation product. Who are these people? They were the best advertising and marketing we could have had. And they were our entree into other retailers because everyone wanted to emulate what Whole Foods was doing.
It's funny that you were successful at Whole Foods because there was a scarcity of products, so you had this vast real estate on the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, Whole Foods is in many ways responsible for the success of the organic and natural product industry. As they succeeded, more and more people said, oh, well, I want to be in that business and I want to create my own products. And all of a sudden, you know, by 2005, it became almost impossible to get onto the shelves of Whole Foods because there were so many new businesses that wanted to do it. You know, we went through periods of time where there were 20, 30, 40, 50 different companies making natural household products more than could fit on the shelves of the store.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. You spent most of your time living in Vermont with your wife, Sheila, and three kids. Why Vermont?
Only because that's where Alan was and that's where the business was. Having been born and raised in Manhattan and having moved back, no one in my family had any interest in going to Vermont. But after Alan left the business and I was commuting up there every week, I mean, for 2 years, I got up Monday morning, flew up to Vermont, spent the week there and came back. I had little kids. I wasn't seeing them. I said to my wife, could we please try living in Vermont so we can be together? I said, you know, let's try this for 2 years. If it doesn't work, we'll move back. After a year and a half, we were moving back. No one was particularly happy. And finally, things sort of turned around right before the end of the second year, and we decided to stay there.
So there's a lot going on in your life. Your family moves to Vermont. The business is starting to turn around. And your brother committed suicide at this time. What happened there, and what effect did that have on you?
Yeah, you know, Peter and I had actually worked together. Not only was he my brother, he was probably my closest friend and someone that I worked with. And, you know, he suffered, as many people in my family and myself suffer from depression. Back in those days, they were probably a little bit less able to deal with it. A decade ago, I wouldn't have ever said that I suffer from depression because it just wasn't something you talked about. He struggled with that with great difficulty. You know, the other side of the coin is that you know, my wife would say that he lived more life in the 35 or so years or that he was alive than most of us do in a lifetime. I mean, he was the most fun person to be around. He always knew where the right party was. We would go away together. My social life was always dependent upon him. He would always make sure that he met two girls, and I was always happy that I got to go out with one of them, even if it was chronically the less attractive of the two. That was always the case. But he was always larger than life. So it was a turning point in my life. I really had to come to terms with the fact that I had to be in the present and enjoy what I had in the moment because I had no idea what tomorrow or the next moment would bring. And as someone who plans a lot of things and likes to feel in control, I really had to come to terms with the fact that all you have is this particular moment in time. And most of us miss that sense of the present.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation, a company that produces natural household and personal care products. In 2008, you stepped down as CEO, and in 2010, you were asked to leave the board of Seventh Generation.
Right.
Talk to me about that experience.
Well, you know, when you realize that you don't have control of things, you know, one could take, after being at Seventh Generation for 23 years, you know, to get fired from a company you started could leave you with a very negative, cynical view about life. And, you know, I've had to come to terms with, okay, it's painful, it sucks, I don't like it, but it's also a gift that has freed me to do something else. And I'm not sure that left on my own, I would have gone and done something else. I was very comfortable. The company was doing very well. And yet, you know, I was thrown out of the nest and had to come to terms with, so what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And being forced to ask that question has been a gift. And it has allowed me to say, wow, I don't want to sell any more toilet paper or laundry detergent or diapers. The world is facing much bigger challenges. While the result of that has led me down a path that I'm excited and thrilled about, the experience and the way it happened was miserable and unpleasant. There's no question about that.
You had brought on other investors, other private equity investors at this time who became board members. How was that experience for you?
You always hope that you're bringing on investors that are aligned with your values. They always sound like they're aligned with your values. The truth is, when things are going well, it's easy for everyone to be aligned around the values. 2008, 2009, the business and the economy went through a lot of turmoil, and I began to drift philosophically further and further away from the perspective of the board and particularly the newer investors in the company. That grew to a point of, you know, what I would say were irreconcilable differences. I have a renewed enthusiasm for governance and legality that ensures that alignment when, you know, things aren't going well. And I had many opportunities to do that, and I didn't take the opportunity to formalize the values in a legal framework that would have made those things clear and unquestionable.
What's an example?
A good example is one of the things that made Seventh Generation unique is that we had a salary cap in place where I, as the highest paid person, never made more than 17 times the lowest paid person in the company. In an environment where people on Wall Street and people running large companies are making 500 times the average, let alone the lowest, it was really unusual to say you can grow a successful company, hire the talent you need, and not pay people unconscionable sums that, aside from being unconscionable, make them think that they're a lot more important and a lot more valuable than they are. Now, there was no governance, no legal framework that held that in place. There should have been. And just like Seventh Generation historically gives away 10% of its profits to charitable nonprofit organizations, there's nothing in our governance or legal framework that does that. So all of the parts of the value system And there's something called B Corporation that is beginning to do some of that. I think that you need to build that into the governance. We have a country where 50% of the country's wealth is held by 1% of the people. And I think that's a dangerous thing for our social fabric, let alone for business.
What now? What are you doing now?
So I am looking to create a financial vehicle that invests in businesses that are committed to creating high-quality, good, permanent jobs, sustainable products, businesses that are driven and served not the interest of an investor, but serve all the other stakeholders that we have to think about, the community, the employees, the environment. We have a huge sector of our economy that is doing that today, but a sector that is not as strong and as vibrant as it could be. And I think that the solution to many of the economic problems we face is ensuring the success and the vibrancy of that part of the economy. The working title is Common Wise Enterprise.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder of Seventh Generation. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. NetSpend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school, before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of, what better way than join the Marines during the time of war?
After college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for NetSpend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for NetSpend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming. And people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards. And the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us to say, we cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill, and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive, but you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that it would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because they used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, you guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players. I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They supported one of our investors, early investors. They had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeffener
here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune 1.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age, where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually were used by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we've now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes, yeah.
And he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you started innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology. You have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. You started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from NetSpend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with NetSpend. What was your response to that?
No, my two cents on that is that it was a silly time for both of us. There's just no reason for it. We clear the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you, because of confidentiality on the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if Netspend won, we lost. But if Netspend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? Netspend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is Netspend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to Netspend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partnered with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the Mi Phone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to go to the collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question, because throughout the early years at Netspend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her PIN, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of $6 Million Man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara.
They
go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, I all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is, it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find the path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, but it was a very empowering feeling, it blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. from an entrepreneur's perspective in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it was fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry, that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs, Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.